And welcome back to the DefendoCast with me, Lisa Schmeiser, and my stalwart companions, Phil Mozelak and Tony Sindelar. Hi, guys!
TV is real.
So is Tony.
Yes, excellent. I'm glad to hear that both of those things exist and in the same universe. So today we are talking about episode 6 of The Defenders, where there's a radical shakeup in HR among a couple different coalitions. Danny discovers that the Iron Fist is no match against the simple Boy Scout knot, and Jessica and Matt continue to be fairly awesome in their own fashion. Regular listeners are aware of how this podcast works. We try to make sure it goes no longer than 40 minutes. At least one of those minutes is devoted to attempting to recap the episode in 60 seconds or less. And then we do deep dives into some of the themes, some of the things that bothered us, some of the things we thought were pretty awesome. So the man on deck for tonight's recap is Phil Mozelak. I hope you've been taking notes. Have you been warming up? Have you been practicing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't practice. And I'm looking at my text. It may be a little bit longer, but if I have to, I'll just, I'll take it on the chin. And get knocked out for hours.
I'm ready to time you, Mo.
Are you ready to be timed? Yes.
I'm ready to be timed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
The Defenders at its best is best when it's exploring relationships between our main heroes. Ash spends a lot of time delving into these character dynamics, splitting everybody into pairs. Danny and Luke, Jessica, Matt, Alexandra and Elektra. Okay, so Wanda has been scrambling the team's eggs to figure out that Danny is possibly a key to a mystery lock. A little bit of fighting brings JJ to knock out Danny for a ridiculous amount of time. Jessica's world, she teams up with Matt to get information about the architect who killed himself before the hand could get to him. Also, Iron Fist is in their grasp, the hands that is, and those fingers of the hand continue to bicker about who's in charge. Andra's sick and tired of listening to it. She asserts her dominance. Elektra refuses to cooperate. She sneaks up on Elektra, sticks her with a sword through the heart, and after telling the fingers of the hand that she's now in control. The end.
Wow. Yeah. That was like 53 seconds. It's hard to say Alexandra and Elektra together, right? That's kind of a tongue twister.
That's why I had the iced tea.
Yeah, that's limber up. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there was, because this episode starts off with Alexandra doing your classic evil person move where she sits alone in her lair and listens to classical music and broods for a while.
Mirrors and reflections.
More shots in mirrors and reflections.
Yeah, yes. And you know, again with the classical music, which suggests that maybe her emotional development stopped sometime in the 1700s. I don't know. What I do think is interesting is how many cliches she embodies in this episode, from the classical music listening to the smirking about the ace and the whole thing she's got going on, to her weird quirk that they never explain about why she doesn't eat with other people, to her very speech at the end where she's busy tearing strips off everybody else. I am the one in charge here. I am the one who has the plan. I am the one who has the vision. Nothing can stop me. Oop, stab.
Don't forget or maybe you're going to get there already. Go for it. Sorry. I thought that was the end of the list because she died. So
no, it was. I am the stab. And what was interesting about that is the death is supposed to be, oh, Alexandra, you're hubris. Because the thing that actually sets Elektra off is the fact that Alexandra doesn't even know Daredevil's name, and Elektra's really irritated that her identity has been subsumed into Alexandra's agenda. So, the weapon has turned on the hand that wields it. But it was so cliche in a lot of ways, because it was classic villain 101, where in comic books and in old B-grade movies, it is always the moment where the supervillain is gloating, where, it all falls apart. And the first time I saw this, I wasn't sure whether to laugh or whether I should be genuinely shocked by them taking out the person who was presumably the big bad 3/4 of the way through the series.
I'll go ahead and say, it's kind of funny. But the bigger problem is, and Sigourney Weaver is a great actress, so it's kind of like, I don't want to laugh, but here we go again. This is the same thing that made me fall off the ladder with Luke Cage, is like you have a really super cool villain, and then you kill them and get a dumb villain.
Yeah, I like how you put that.
It's really simple, and for some reason, that seems to be a formula for success in the Netflix universe? I don't know.
It's supposed to be shocking, right? It's like, you think this is going to be the thing. This is not the thing. I will say I was shocked. I was surprised when she gets stabbed by Elektra. I did not see that coming in the end of the episode. I did not have that spoiled for me ahead of time, so that was nice. It was probably diminished a little bit because we had just seen another hand leader get killed at the end of the previous episode. So, again, it's the whole thing where the five most evil ninjas in the world are just getting picked off left and right. And really,
like within a 48-hour period. Like, they've lived for millennia, and yet 48 hours in New York City, and their fatality rates of 40%.
You know, I'm willing to believe that, like, they are in an incredibly precarious situation and everything, and all of their plans. They bet too hard on the wrong plan, and now everything's falling apart. But it is falling apart hard, and, you know, I don't know. If I was a ninja, I would say, all right, let's just stop here, let's disappear into the shadows, and let's regroup. Especially if they're immortal, like, let's regroup in 50 years. We can wait this out.
Madame Gao had that plan. She was like, I'm with you as long as we can get through the gates to Kunlun. I hate that name. But she's such a little sneaky sneak.
I honestly thought that she was set up for another coup, because she has all of these character building scenes in this episode where first Alexander's like, we have survived assassination attempts by each other. Like, camera moves to Gao, who suddenly looks like butter wouldn't melt in her mouth.
Miss Mrs. Butterworth.
Yeah, and there's adorable. There's a line,
and
right,
then
about
there's that
where,
scene, yeah.
where she...
And then there's that scene in Alexandra's room where she's like, oh, you know, you were the one who tried to kill me. You were the one who started the coup last time. When Gao's like, look, it's us dames against these two idiot men. And she tries to play that card, and Alexandra's not having it. And she's like, Gao, you were the one who led the coup last time. And I thought to myself, surely this is where we're going, where, you know, Gao is old enough... Because her goals are different enough, and Alexandra's are based on fear, and Gao's are not. They're based on a kind of like a hopeful loss, if that makes sense. You know, she's lost something, she's hoping she can get it back. It's a different motivation thing, so maybe she's more capable of being patient and work in Bakudo, and I'm blanking on his name. The wolf killing dude. Work in those two,
Murakami,
so that they
I think.
Murakami, yes. So working those two and be like, okay, we can flank Alexandra, let her deal with the Black Sky. It's not going to end well because there's four ragtag psychopaths on our tail. And like you said, go to ground for 50 years. And then they'll outlive this group of idiots and they can come back and do it again.
But they can't get any more Iron Fists. So there is the rub. I mean, there's no more Iron Fists after this one, in theory, right?
Oh, because Kunlun went away. Yeah.
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 So I guess they would have, but again, you can easily outweigh most of them and find a way to get to Danny, through other means. He's already shown he's not bright. There are ways you can get to him.
Mm-hmm. Just get him like a really dangerous job where he might lose his hand. Like, hey, Danny, would you want to work at this meatpacking plant? How about some light construction work? Would you like to be an assistant to a sloppy magician?
They all know how to press psychological buttons. It wouldn't be that hard for them to pull another Bakudo-esque scam on Danny. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't know Murakami. And if they were smart, they would have had that guy come in with a whole, I want to rebuild the armies of the chaste in honor of what happened, and he gets his trust, and Danny builds an army, and he's so close to getting back to Kunlun, and then Danny iron fists and shakes hands with the dragon or whatever he's going to do to get Kunlun back, and boom, Gao shows up. Boom, Murakami's like, Madam Gao, so happy to see you.
I like that story better.
Yeah. Because this is the thing that we get in all of the in Iron Fist, and then in this series, what we've gotten is that Danny is desperate to get back into a company of people with a shared mission. Like, for all that he left Kunlun because my parents, it was evident that he had a sense of purpose and a sense of camaraderie and a sense of belonging there because he knew what he was supposed to do as the Iron Fist. He's now trying to rebuild that here with people who desperately want to like not be part of a band, and. Ageless immortal people who have had plenty of time to study human psychology and know all about Danny Rand could could fake him out again. Like, just keep Bakudo far away from the operation and you're good.
I feel like there's kind of a mix-up in the storytelling, in maybe not so much in Defenders, but as in the all the, you know, dozens of hours of media that we homeworked before we did Defenders, mm-hmm. where you've got this kind of muddle of, is the Hand, like, playing the long game because they're immortal and they have all these ties to these corporations and they can build a giant hole in the middle of New York and build a skyscraper over it just for cover, just mm-hmm. because they can. And like, they have this plan that's finally about to pay off that they have been working on for like hundreds of years, and they can just do that because that's how that works, versus like, this is the last days of a falling empire and they are desperate to get back to Kunlun because their immortality is at risk. Right? Like, I feel like both of those stories have been told, and they don't really reconcile with each other.
No, especially when they're all coming together in one.
Yeah, and it just feels jumbled.
And again, this points to the growing problem in the MCU, which now that you have umpteen hours of TV plus umpteen mm-hmm. movies and so on and so forth, there are developments that happen where you're like, this literally makes no sense. Mm-hmm. Because you're like, this makes no sense when you think about, well, this is happening in the same world as Doctor Strange.
They need a Kathleen Kennedy is what they need.
Yeah. No, they do. I mean, that's the thing is, look, for all the quibbles we could have over how Star Wars has been executed, they have people who literally do nothing but figure out the world building and how events that happened in one series are going to play out over the next, six or seven lines. And this is something I don't think the MCU has really thought through. They like to think they have a plan and they have phases and movies and so on and so forth, but their world building is getting increasingly shaky.
I mean, I think basically the strategy they have chosen is, we are going to make lots of movies that are going to, and TV shows that are going to make lots of money. And that we're just producing...
Only you nerds will complain.
Yeah. We're producing stuff at such a rate that, like, how could we possibly expect everybody talking to everybody? We're giving you a million things. And honestly, are you suckers still buying all of this? Because this is, like, how much of you do we own at this point?
God, yeah. I feel so dirty now. I feel so used now.
It's just right, like comic talk, books, can I talk but now real it's quick on the about, screen.
So. Yeah, let me talk about Danny real quick. This is pretty key. I think this is an acting issue over a character issue. Did you guys feel like he was trying to have a sense of pride, but mm-hmm. Lack of a better term, I say like civic responsibility to, you know, defend New York, but it came off, however, as a big ego trip, like, you guys are against me. You can't get in my way. I'm gonna get you with my super fist. And then Matt takes him to task, gives him a couple mm-hmm. roundhouses, and then literally, like, folks, I have to say this, okay? Mm-hmm. There's two issues, and it's coming up next episode. But Jay Jones, again, the power mm-hmm. issue. Can she break through handcuffs? I think she can.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Okay. That's like, in Jessica Jones, she just, I mean, I am unclear if she is the strongest one on the team. I think she might
be. Yeah. And so, because, but now, the she way
she
hits him.
She may not think she is the thing.
Like, I think she just doesn't, like, she doesn't use it very, so for example, you didn't work your way all the way through Jessica Jones, Mose, but like, basically, you know, she's a private investigator and she's exploring mysteries. Somebody must have done a supercut of basically anytime Jessica Jones needs to get into somewhere, like, she just mm-hmm. rips the door handle off a door and then opens the door. Like,
right.
She does that, like, almost every episode in Jessica
Jones. So breaking out of handcuffs would not be a big deal.
No, not at all.
Right. But, and then hitting somebody in the face like that, mm-hmm. knock to the point that you want to knock them out in a one-punch solution.
Totally. In fact, I would suspect that perhaps... If anything, she has to be careful about pulling her punches and not hitting people.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like she doesn't hit a lot of people in the Jessica Jones show because, like, she's worried about hurting people. She'll do property damage left and right, but, you know, she might be concerned that she would break your jaw or worse, right?
Yeah, yeah, because that was the thing, is I had the feeling that she's like, I'm really sorry, Danny, I have to do this. And it was kind of a tap, which is good, because, like, the full JJ would have been, like, his jaw would have been powder, and episode six and a half through eight would be him in, like, you know, bandages with a
He would have his jaw wired shut, and he couldn't talk, so. Yeah.
That, right. You know, I mean, he was just out for a long time. Improve. I mean, that's like hospitalization-level concussed. Yeah. CTE out the wazoo. Sleeping.
They've had like a pretty intense. They've had a pretty intense couple of days though. So maybe he was just catching up on his shot.
All right, I'll accept it. Never mind. Forget everything I said. He was just sleepy.
I was annoyed that they had to have the inner team fighting. Like I wanted one of them to be like, "Stop! We're not doing this. Let's talk about this." Right.
This is like another thing that I think is kind of a weakness of the superhero trope is in general, and sometimes writers in comics are like, well, you have all these really big egos with powers, and they're not used to negotiating, and so of course they're going to fight with each other because it's a dominance thing. Yeah,
friends fight first.
Yeah, and you know, again in the Avengers, it happened where you had the 3-way fight first, and they all had to team up. But you know, here I think the only thing that made the Matt versus Danny thing remotely interesting is, like Mo said, Danny is kind of coming at this from a sense of noblesse oblige, and well, naturally I would take care of my adopted city, good chap. I'm Danny Rand, billionaire and Iron Fist, and Matt Murdock is all, screw you! I live in Hell's Kitchen, and I have fought my way into an Esquire title, and I will defend my city. Who are you to come in? So it's like the gentrification argument, except with superheroes.
I was like bored, because I feel like we've already done the trope where the heroes fight because there's a misunderstanding, and like I'm kind of okay with that, but then now they're fighting because they have poor people skills, and that bothers me. Like we get a little bit of it in Defenders already, where the Flash and Arrow trope, where it's like, I have a secret, and because it's a secret, there'll be problems later. And so I don't like it. I'm reminded again of in Flash and Arrow, I enjoy when like Oliver and Barry like are training against each other, and so they get to fight in a carefree training situation and not in a because we were bad at talking situation. So also I'm reminded of that time that Oliver shot Barry with the like robot arrows, and that was hilarious. Oh, so
Barry's all and Oliver's like, these are what bad guys will do, so hop too.
I do appreciate the fact that we were getting down to actually some detective work, and that, you know, Jessica's like, well, wait a minute, the architect, this thing doesn't work out. I mean, that's like a really cool linchpin and a good thread to them getting the answers that they need. And I don't know, you know, they don't spend a whole lot of time on it. They spend just enough time to where we're filling in the details and they're filling in the blanks as well. But like, it's almost like that could be, and maybe, I'll be honest with you, this is kind of one of those things I'm coming at it from just watching Blade Runner. But having a detective type story, like, I personally like that a lot, especially when I don't know what's happening and I'm working with the heroes to figure out what's up.
And I thought having the blueprints hidden in a piano, you know, kind of silly and comic booky, but kind of fun as a mystery also, right? You know?
That whole scene, the reason... So, I love that whole thing, first of all, because Jessica and Matt talking with each other, what I enjoy and find interesting about the way this is shaking out is that she and Luke are back on a wavelength that works for them. You know, because when she's like, I don't keep in touch, but you could have called, and he's like, all right, fair enough, this is how you are, this is how I'll own it. But I really like how she and Matt spark off each other. And I like it because there's like no sexual or romantic thing there. They kind of get each other in some sort of, you too, huh? Yeah, me too. And the scene where they're walking down the street, and she's like, oh, you know, how does these brownstones, they all look alike. And this is her, you know, chatting with him comfortably.
Well, I think they have a lot to learn from each other.
Yeah, because and she's like, crap, you're blind, and he's really amused that she forgot and that she's treating him like an intimate as opposed to just this stranger. It was such a great scene, so casual. I loved it.
And see, the thing is, he wears a costume and takes on fully the mantle of a hero, you know, superhero vigilante. She resists that, but I think they both kind of see like what the other one has or does. And so there's a good dichotomy, but there's also some push and pull between them of like, this is how I do things, this is how you do things. And it doesn't always jive, but we can learn from each other on like how we go about like doing your detective work or resisting the need to wear a costume or the reasons why it's good to wear a costume so people don't see your face.
Yeah, I liked it when she basically like quietly laid out for Matt that she had done her homework on him when she's talking to the teenage girl. And she doesn't look at him. She doesn't even allude to it. And Matt plays it really cool, too. So I thought that was interesting. And I also thought it was interesting how Matt kind of plays a hard-ass attorney compared to, because he recognizes that Jessica's the one who has the more humane connection. And watching him deal with the teenage girl with a completely different change in tone. And he's like, you know, you're covered, you're fine, I'm your attorney, here we go. And I was like, wow, this is kind of different than how he would treat people when he and Foggy were avocados at law. But again, they get each other as working partners. And I like that you can see something like that develop over the course of the show. So that was delightful for me. I did enjoy the squabbling among the hand. I mean, I kind of agree that the actor who plays Bakuda was doing a lot of soap opera acting choices with, we didn't even try to look for him and stuff like that. And you're like, oh my God, just dial it back. But I enjoyed the squabbling. I enjoyed the idea that these dudes have, in fact, not spent their many thousands of years doing the live and let live thing with each other. And I liked when Murakami was like, no, I was fine with leaving Kunlun. It's you I've never been fine with. But
see, I don't think you can say that. Like, I don't think you can pull that off this far down the chute. Like, really? We almost had to have, like, some of this kind of stuff kind of at least glimpsed of, like, within the first couple episodes. Like, I feel like it's just like, what? We're doing this now, and like, but now we're going to lose a player in all this? I don't know. I mean, and I feel bad for, like, what's his name? Sawande. Because, yeah. I mean, he gave out a lot of information. He was actually kind of interesting because we got to hear him talk to our our heroes. And, you know, I don't know. It was one of those things I was kind of sad to see him go, but it did give the what's in the box moment.
Yeah. The what's in the box? What's in the box? It was so I thought that was interesting. I thought the Gao and Alexandra stuff was particularly interesting, especially since you would have to realize that their experience over thousands of years would have been substantially different than the three dudes in the hand. And I would have been fascinated to have writers who understood that and like laid it out as in, well, this is how we've had to approach it to stay alive and watch so-called progress happen. Or if there were other ways that the fault line split among the five of them. That said, I don't really enjoy the erratic 45-degree turn they took with Electra, where, oh, she wakes up, she's in Matt's house, she sees the card that he keeps in his book, that's her prayer card, and she sniffs around for a bit, and then she sees the weapons that she used to use, and then Alexandra has the nerve not to use her ex's name, so boop, there go the kidneys. I was like, really? This is where we choose to go with this? Because the reason I was rolling my eyes over it is, does this mean the last two episodes are going to be Matt, Electra, no, you have good in you. And she's all, nope, wrong, immortal. I've decided I'm 100% all in. Electra, no, wrong. You know, because that was all of season two of Daredevil. And I got tedious. I don't want to see it get tedious like that again.
And besides that, she's in charge now? I don't know.
That threw me. I was like, what's going on here? And it's, I don't know. There's a lot of people with mysterious agendas. And so it's the hand infighting and it being very unclear what's going on with Elektra. Because I thought, I mean, and again, I have not seen the end, so there may be exciting things happening. I thought Elektra is regaining her identity. So then I guess I was confused. Why does she then want to run the hand? But perhaps that will make more sense to me as I see more episodes, or I am totally blanking on very important things about the nature of Elektra. Also, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you just
you're asking yourself the question of what is it that Elektra really wants?
And I have no idea, I guess. Well,
and that's a problem.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know because, you know, they could have done a better job of outlining in prior episodes that what she wants is to not be treated as a void in which they've poured the black sky, right? Because Alexandra did a whole lot of, my child, and you used to be this person, but you're not now, you're this way. And Alexandra was trying to erase her personality, but if we had seen more of Elektra actively subverting and fighting back against that, then the betrayal and the stabbing would have made more sense. What we got was Murakami saying a few things here and there, like, oh, maybe the black sky isn't all that. Mm-hmm. And that was it, you know?
I was also confused because of the kind of order of events where we have Elektra, like, exploring Matt's apartment and kind of, it seems like, reconnecting with her identity, maybe not any in restored yet. And then she goes on the fetch quest to get Danny Rand, and she beats them all up. But I guess the important thing there is she doesn't kill anyone, but she grabs Danny and runs away. So, like, I was confused that it's like she takes everybody out. So that was surprising.
Yeah, it was a little,
and she killed Stick, so.
Yeah.
Oh, and can we talk about Stick, who had tried to kill Danny, too?
That's a pretty big one.
We have that sneaky SOB who bides his time and tries to get inside Luke's head, the same way that all of the members of the Hand tend to get into people's heads when they're tied up. And
Stick is a real the ends justify the mean kind of guy. So
I mean,
it's a little hard to parse because, like, Danny is like the the embodiment of Kunlun, which I guess he is sworn to protect, but at the same time he now represents a weapon for the Hand with the it's like, I guess in Stick's mind, it's like, well, there'll be another Iron Fist, and we got to do this to stop the Hand now.
Or Stick's like, well, Kunlun is lost to us already, so whatever. Good, we had a good millennia run.
If he can cut it all away, then his game gets, well, doesn't even get pushed forward. He doesn't have to. The game isn't there anymore. The game's over.
Yeah.
So it's funny. You know, I almost forgot that Stick dies because we have Elektra's Alexander's death at the hands of Elektra is kind of the big sudden move. But yeah, we've dropped several characters in a pretty short amount of time in these episodes, which kind of starts to make them, like, I don't know. It's a lot happening quickly, so I feel like with each successive one, kind of starts to have diminishing returns.
Because, like, if you kill off the other three members of the Hand over the next two episodes, like, meh, wow, there you go, bye,
all wrapped up, so
you can almost start to see, it's like, oh, okay, so it's gonna be Elektra that's left, you know what I mean, like, if you just, and I'm not even spoiling anything because
I think Madame Gao's a survivor. I think she gets to walk away in the end, having not seen the ending, my expectation is, like, you know, she always has a backup plan.
Yeah, she's sneaky.
She's smart, though. I think when you take a look at how they sketched out the personality archetypes for the five members of the Hand, you had Sawande, who was clearly like, well, immortality is a great racket for getting rich and amassing power, and so that's what he did with it. And you have Murakami, who is all, well, immortality is a great way to render several species extinct for my own personal entertainment.
Alexandra is into, you know, property, buying property.
She's into culture and power. Like, she's decided that commerce, the levers of commerce and culture are the levers that she pushes. Bakudo is busy with his, I believe in potential and people, and I'm going to build armies.
He's almost started, like, the religion version of the Hand, right?
Exactly. So. Yeah. He's basically, you know, he's like the Scientology branch. It's all, you know, evangelism and, and recruitment. And meanwhile, Gao is just like, well, she seems like an opportunistic species, if that makes sense. Like, right now in New York City, it makes sense to run drugs because there's a market for it and there's an easily exploitable workforce and there are competitors where she can direct other people's attention and interest so she can quietly melt away. And assuming she lives through this and assuming the MCU stretches another 100 years, maybe in 25 years, she's busy data washing in the cloud. And, you know, 25 years after that, she's like trading energy or whatever the next big scam is.
She goes transcendence on us.
Madame Gao may well be the singularity for all we know, but I'm openly rooting that they make her effectively like an immortal nemesis, because it would be a really radical thing for any superhero franchise to say, yes, the most terrifying person on the planet is a 4 foot high elderly Chinese woman, because
she's a dragon.
she's a dragon in human skin,
right?
You know, but she's great. I love her as a character, and I really enjoy that here you see her where you can tell that Alexandra unnerves her with what she's doing and her dumb strategies, and you can also tell that she's like, I'm in this for only as long as it's useful to me. And the minute it starts to be stupid, I am out of this. I am finding a way to, perhaps I'll throw the kingpin at you and see how that works out. You know, I'm open to ideas. So there's that. But yeah, this episode, I wouldn't say, I mean, there are parts of it that I found enjoyable, and there were individual scenes I liked a lot. I'm not sure I enjoyed this episode.
It's a little uneven. I believe there is
it
literally...
It was a furniture moving episode.
I was thinking of your voice saying that as I was watching it. I believe there is literally a line in the, I think when Murakami and Alexandra are at what might be her last dinner, where I believe somebody has the "you and I are not so different," you and I are not so different line. I was like, people who write comic book shows should be like, if you write that line, you just immediately delete it. They should have a script that does that, because I believe that line gets repeated later in the series.
Well, yeah, like, they really? Also do that whole, if you never really knew me at all, if you ever knew me at all, and you're like, oh, that's another big cliche too.
Well, and it's like this idea of like, what's good and evil? Is it really so evil that we're trying to get back to our old place and be immortal? Is it really that bad?
It's only acceptable if Jessica Jones is there and she says, "Oh my God, you immortal people are so melodramatic and cliche."
Yeah,
I hate
if she's like, you know, I realize you have all the time in the world to be melodramatic here, but some of us only have a few decades left, and we'd like to not spend them listening to you go on, Bakudo. Like, in an ideal world, Bakudo tries his business on calling around Jessica, and Jessica just like lays him out with a punch. I mean, I would love to see that. Where she's like, I am up to here with men who mansplain me. So, but we won't get that.
So, did we like this episode?
I mean, furniture moving, setting up. It was okay. We do. Is there? There's no check in with the side characters, right? We know they're all still hanging out safe in the police station, but they don't.
Yeah.
We don't even check in with them in this episode, right?
No, I think that's coming.
Yeah. You mentioned Colleen, and I was like, well, I don't think we even see Colleen at all this episode. Which I always feel like
we see these people.
I know they've got all the side characters are tucked off in the same police station, but
yeah,
like,
the whole time.
Kinda, I know it kind of feels like Colleen and Claire should be around. Like I feel like they are kind of the most like we know what's going on with ninjas and stuff. Like we're the least. I mean, I guess they're still mortal the least kind of mentally and physically fragile, right? Foggy should be like way at the back, so you know, behind a file cabinet, just so no one like hits him with a throwing star.
Not in the face.
yeah. If either of them had any three of them had like a page, maybe a page and a half of dialogue, that might be the extent of it so far.
Yeah.
Well, I think the problem with having the sub characters in there is it distracts the focus from the ensemble, because the only scene I could see justifiably in this episode would be somebody at the police station like twiddling their thumbs and going, I don't know why I bother with these people, because they drop off the grid for 48 hours at a time, they come back, they're sore, they mutter incoherent things that don't make sense, they don't bother to explain, and then they're off again. You know, I would be kind of interested in hearing from their perspective why they stick around a little bit, or maybe having someone go, girl, it is never going to get better, or son, it is never going to get better. But otherwise, I feel like if you had had somebody like that in this episode, the focus would have been shifted away from what we did get, which was the fingers of the hand all flipping each other off, and the different working dyads, where you had Danny and Luke understanding each other, and Luke is of course dadding everybody on the team again, because that's what he did to Danny here, because only Luke could make you actually feel like being tied up in a room with stick is not necessarily the worst thing in the world until the very moment when it is. So I don't see where it would have been useful having, say, Karen or Colleen or anyone else, you know, running around through that.
Yeah, anybody else got a line on what that vaporizer was that Stick was playing around with that didn't seem to mess with him?
I was like, why didn't it get him? Why is it only getting Luke?
He's been building up a immunity to
reference acknowledged.
Yeah, so
that might be it.
I don't know. Or maybe he like totally just blew it all into Luke's face.
Shotgunning it.
Yeah.
Or maybe he's like, you know, I'm gonna die anyway, so I've already hacked off my hand and run around, so what are some scalding lungs on my way to murder an Iron Fist?
Did Danny get affected by it, or was he still on knockout street? I can't remember.
He was,
Like, he came to just in time to see Stick heading for him with a sword and began screaming.
Okay, gotcha. Ah!
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's traumatic. So so there was that. But yeah, I mean, overall, if you wanted to rate this on another thumbs up, thumbs level, thumbs down, this is thumbs level, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a B.
It moves stuff forward. It got the job done. You know, you watch it because if you don't, you spend the next few episodes wondering what happened. But it has not, it didn't make me like, whoa, like episodes 3 and 4 did.
Yeah.
Like, I still feel like 4 was one of the
nice moments,
series.
But it doesn't quite have the kind of the sparkle and polish that we've seen in some other episodes. So
yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what we're going to do now, faithful listeners, is we are almost at 40 minutes. So I think having had all of us go meh for the last 30 seconds of the queue, we've said everything useful and interesting about this episode. Let's call it a wrap. I was Lisa Schmeiser, and with me, as always, are Phil Mosalak.
I like Sticks Ganja.
And, oh my God, this is where I fall over. Thunk. And Tony Sindelar.
Don't inhale.
All right, good night, nerds.